Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to Kudzu Vine for March 6, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, tonight we're going to talk about wrapping up Super Tuesday, Super Saturday, looking forward to caucuses and primaries. We're going to talk about the Georgia Senate race. And a little bit later, probably about 15 minutes from now, Jeff Singer of Daily Kos Elections is going to come on. He's going to tell us a little bit about both Louisiana, and he's going to tell us a little bit about national politics as well. And so that'll be interesting when he comes on. But the first topic I think we have to mention, of course, you can see, you know, much more extensive bios and whatnot on other sources, but former First Lady Nancy Reagan passed away about midday today, and obviously it's kind of the major news story of the day. And I think whether people liked her or disliked her, she probably was maybe the most outspoken, influential Republican First Lady in our history because, you know, she maybe not be there with Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton, but Republican First Ladies seem to, for whatever reason, not be as vocal and as type A as personality as Nancy Reagan was. Tim, agree, disagree, think differently than that assessment?
Yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, she was a very strong influence on her husband and in the White House itself. I don't think that she went hardcore in shape policy or things like that. But there's no doubt that she was someone the president leaned on. You know, it's a funny thing. I was sitting here thinking, we're far enough now away from the 70s and the 80s that a lot of those people are passing from the scene now, or they are very old, and we're losing just about all the political people from that age. But, yeah, I would say she might be the top Republican First Lady of all time.
Yeah, I mean, as far as influence and doing that,
yes,
you could. Yes. It's hard to quantify. Somebody can be a silent backbone.
Obviously, I'm a Democrat. She's a Republican. We're not going to agree politically. But just looking at the thing straightforward, I would have to say that she was probably, if you were ranking Republican first ladies, I think I would rank her number one.
Yeah, and if you kind of did the mold, I mean, I guess Barbara Bush then was more outspoken than her daughter-in-law. Her daughter-in-law kind of fell back in, you know, almost into the woodwork. I mean, I think there's a lot of streets in America Laura Bush could walk down and nobody would know her. I think if Nancy Reagan walks down a street almost anywhere in America in, say, 1990, 2 years after she left the White House, yeah, most people are going to know who she is. Catherine, anything to add?
I admire someone who, you know, she had a very rich and long life, and I think that's admirable. And I'm sure her family is sad today, but you can't deny that, you know, she was, what, 94? So they had her for a mm-hmm. long time, and, you know, I think that's, you know, something to be grateful for. And I'm not going to comment on her role as First Lady, just because I don't have anything nice to say.
Yeah, I think they reported that the cause of death was heart failure. I think if your heart, you know, beats quality for 94 years, it did its job.
Yeah.
You know, that's
oh, yeah.
not a partisan thing. That's a, you know, it's kind of a long time for a heart to beat strong. And one more little comment. Because she was from Hollywood and that was her background, that may be why she was more comfortable being more outspoken than others. Because, you know, she was in front of a camera. When she, and I really don't know what she played in. I couldn't speak. I couldn't fill up one of those small Post-it notes on my knowledge of her acting career. I just know she was an actress. Any ideas on what you played in?
I have definitely seen the movie Hellcats of the Navy. she and her husband actually appeared in that film together, and if I'm not mistaken, that might have been about the last movie that she made. Now, there's an interesting thing about her. When she first started getting big in Hollywood in the late 40s, well, guess what happened to her? She wound up on one of good old Joe McCarthy's watch lists.
Really?
It almost ruined her. And so she sought a meeting with the president of the Screen Actors Guild to try to help her out. And guess who that was? Ronald Reagan.
Reagan.
Yeah, and there's how they met, right there, because of Joe McCarthy. Just a little trivia for you trivia folks.
Yeah, interesting if they would have, yeah, if they would have looked at how, what Joe McCarthy did in a different way and had anger towards Joe McCarthy's party, how history might have been rewritten in a different way. Well, let's go ahead and segue on to politics today and talk about, you know, the state of the presidential race. Super Tuesday, good night for Hillary Clinton, good night for Donald Trump. Not a terrible night for Ted Cruz, but not at all a good night for Marco Rubio, unless you think that Minnesota is the end-all be-all of politics in America, which apparently Marco Rubio supporters feel that way. Catherine, what do you think about the state of the race?
Oh, geez. You know, I watched a lot of their returns on Tuesday night, and it was all very puzzling, like this new thing where instead of having a returns party, Donald Trump has a press conference. I guess he did it twice this week. Nothing surprised me. I was not surprised by any of the results. I'm surprised by the reactions, the sort of victory speeches when there's no victory, and this press conference that was so weird with Chris Christie standing behind him, and the whole thing was just surreal. It's just too much like a scary movie now for me.
Yeah, I think we were all watching those returns and on Tuesday night and texting and emailing each other. And it was so strange. Now, Hillary Clinton, she had probably the best election night speech. I liked hers Tuesday night much better than last night.
Yes, she was very strong, I thought.
Hers was a traditional one. The Donald Trump press conference, apparently this is a new tactic. I guess if he wins the nomination, somebody will say this is the new wave of the future. I'm not sure. It seems like you can control a speech much better than you can control the questions you get. So eventually you're going to get caught up in a question. The weirdest thing was Marco Rubio did an interview before the Minnesota returns came in, and you would have thought that he had had the best night of any of the candidates on either side at that point. It was so weird. I mean, it's like, does he not do math the same way that we do? I mean, like, in his world, is 9 like a bad number and 1 a good one? You know, like, 11 is a great percentage and 99 is awful? Because, I mean, it was just so weird. Tim, what'd you think?
That it was weird, yes.
No. And you can respond to the whole anything on the right.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just the one thing that blew me away.
As for all the other stuff, we have to look at yesterday's results too, because for the first time, somebody beside Donald Trump really made a move. Ted Cruz had a very good day yesterday. He is now, depending on who you look at, 85 to 95 delegates behind Trump.
Yeah.
He's within 100 of him. He's within striking distance. He won more delegates yesterday than Trump did. He outright won a couple of contests. Shockingly, one of those was Maine, where the governor, for instance, up there had endorsed Trump. And he was close to Trump in both Kentucky and Louisiana. I've got to wonder if the last debate finally didn't start hurting Trump just a little bit. Maybe he crossed the line with the, you know, there's no problem there stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he crossed the line with me a long time ago, but I cringed when he said that the other night, especially in the hopes that not a lot of children were watching it and turned to ask their mothers and fathers what he meant by that.
Excuse me.
But since we've gone on the air, Rubio, I'm sitting here looking at it now, has won down in Puerto Rico. He's finally won something else. And if he tops 50%, he'll get all 23 of the delegates there. But still, Cruz is closer to Trump than Rubio is to second place. Those two have separated themselves from the other two.
And oh, yeah.
So now
I think it's funny. Go ahead.
Now we look at what's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks, and there's going to be a lot of delegates on both sides. By the time the smoke clears on the 15th, Hillary Clinton could be three-fourths of the way to the nomination. Did y'all know that? Just by the
15th,
I
mean,
she could be three-fourths of the way to the delegates that she needs already to win. So, you know, she's pretty well coasting to the nomination now on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, we just don't have a clear front runner right now because it's just too split up.
So
before
we move on to all the things ahead, can we talk about Mitt Romney for a minute?
Oh, well, yeah, we can talk about that. I mean, I will say this real quick. I think that Ted Cruz of either side probably has the most momentum, even though Hillary Clinton probably sits in the best spot of anybody. Yeah, Mitt Romney, who made him kingmaker, Catherine?
I don't know. That was crazy, wasn't it? Somebody said it was like your old boyfriend who you broke up with is trying to get back together with you. But the weird thing was, so that morning when he made his speech, and then Trump was landing in Maine, and I was having lunch at the little pizza place in the building where I work, and they had the TV on with the sound down on CNN, and they had for like 15 minutes or longer, like half an hour, they had the camera on an empty stage with the backdrop of the American flags or something, waiting for Donald Trump. So Wolf Blitzer just kept saying, and the scroll along the bottom was, soon to arrive, Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump to arrive very soon. I mean, it was like I was waiting for them to count down, you know, okay, he's here, he's in the building, you know, he's walking to the stage, he'll be here very, very soon. It was crazy, but they just kept that camera on that empty stage. Like there was no other news.
I know, they shouldn't have kept cutting to it, I guess that's what ratings, they were waiting for that, and that's where the ratings come in. But he was waiting for Kentucky to be called for him because Louisiana got called pretty quick, and it seems like he was waiting. They couldn't call it because Jefferson County, which is Louisville, no returns were in on that at that point. But talking about Mitt Romney, what kind of surprises me is, let's play a little game. More or less consequential as far as a federal career in politics of all the nominees that lost the presidency. Would you say John McCain has more or less of a consequential career than Mitt Romney, Tim?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Okay, John
he
McCain.
Does.
Catherine, John McCain or
yes.
Mitt Romney?
John McCain.
John McCain? John McCain. Okay, let's go back. John Kerry, Mitt Romney.
John Kerry.
Y'all yelling?
Well, Kerry, of course.
Yeah, Gore, Romney.
Probably about equal.
Well,
I would
Gore
say
was vice
Gore
president.
Because of all
Gore's
the,
vice president.
You know, the,
oh, that's
yeah.
true.
He's
okay.
won a, he's
oh,
won
I
a Nobel
put him.
Prize.
I didn't put Gore.
Oh, that's true. He won the Nobel Prize. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
sorry.
Well, and okay, and we can keep going back. Dole, Romney.
How about anybody, Romney? You know?
I mean, that's what was...
David
McLaughlin, Romney. Linda Wilkie, by the time we finish the show. You see what I'm saying? What is the deal with Mitt Romney's influence? John McCain and Bob Dole on the Republican side ought to have more say on this thing. It's absurd. Well, now that we've gotten all into absurd land, let's bring it back a little bit with somebody that knows all about everything that's everything, both on the national and the Louisiana scene. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine from Daily Kos Elections, Mr. Jeff Singer. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, thanks.
Hi,
great to be back.
Yeah, well, and Jeff, if you have a love and affinity for Mitt Romney and his federal political career, we're sorry if we offended you, but we wrapped that up. and now, look, we know that you have a history in the Bayou State, but then also you know all about national politics. So this time I want to kind of double dip with you. But let's start off with Louisiana. I guess since we're talking federal stuff, let's just talk about the results in the Democratic and the Republican primaries in Louisiana. Just tell us your Louisiana state version of what happened.
All right. So we had both parties' presidential primaries yesterday on Saturday night. And as expected on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton easily carried the state. She won almost every parish. That was pretty much what we've been expecting since she did overwhelmingly well in South Carolina. Hillary's done very well with African-American voters, and especially in a state with Louisiana, where voting is so racially polarized, in a Democratic primary, if you're doing well with African-American voters, you're doing very, very well overall. The Republican side was much more surprising. What little polling we'd seen said that Donald Trump would easily carry the state, and he did win, but he only beat Ted Cruz by about he only beat him about 31 to 38%, much closer than we expected. And Ted Cruz had a few other bad – I'm sorry, Donald Trump had a few other bad results last night also, and it's too early to tell if something's really gone wrong for him or maybe he just got a few bad pair of states, but it is much more – it's pretty notable that he didn't do it nearly as well as everyone thought he would in Louisiana especially.
Yeah, just a question, and this may be part of the answer. The Duck Dynasty family, have they weighed in on this Republican primary?
That's a really good question. I'm not actually sure if they have or not. I feel like I'm going to check this, and I'm going to feel really dumb that I forgot, but I don't think they have. But that said, I don't want to say that they don't have much influence in politics, but I think with any celebrity endorsement, it doesn't really move that many voters, even if they're someone who's really beloved. There's just,
yeah,
I think most people just, they can make a distinction between a celebrity and who they're voting for. If they happen to be on the same page as such celebrity, they might say, oh yeah, I'm totally voting with the Duck Dynasty people, but otherwise, they can very well say, I like them, but my heart's with Trump or Cruz.
Yeah, I just knew they had a lot of influence in that congressional race a while back. Now, they got burned because the guy kind of, you know, left the reservation on them when he got to Washington and had personal
yeah.
shortcomings. But then, and that may have caused them to not want to get involved in politics, but I
yeah.
didn't know because I thought, well, I noticed there was a county or two a parish or two up north that Ted Cruz carried, and I don't know the Louisiana map well enough to know if that was Monroe or not, but I know they're from Monroe, which is a decent sized city in northeastern Louisiana. I thought, well, maybe if they endorse, that's why those two parishes went for Cruz possibly, and that was just a theory, but could be a bad
yeah.
one. Just
I mean, it's I, they could have had some influence, and I think for lower tier races like congressional races where the voters just don't know that candidate that well, being the Duck Dynasty candidate could help. But for at this point in the presidential race, pretty much everyone knows who Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are, so a big celebrity endorsement or a political endorsement is not going to move that many votes, even if they're just someone completely beloved.
Yeah. Well, given that we all know who the Apprentice candidate is, you know, and no other reality shows. Well, I'm going to pass it over to Catherine, then Tim, and they can continue to ask questions about maybe the Democratic side of this Louisiana primary or something else. Catherine?
Thanks for being on tonight, Jeff. We really appreciate it. I'm going to be in New Orleans next week, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, great.
So how is the – so here in Georgia we have, like, a lot of sort of – I wouldn't say battling, but you might say it, between the supporters of Senator Sanders and the supporters of Secretary Clinton. There's, like, you know, the Bernie bros and the Hillary bros and the, you know, she's not really a Democrat, he's not really a Democrat. Has there been any of that kind of activity in Louisiana, or have you not noticed it?
I haven't noticed too much. I would say, just based on how big of a blowout it was in Louisiana, there probably wasn't too much energy. And part of Bernie Sanders' big base is white liberals, and we don't have that many in Louisiana right now. There are some in New Orleans, and there are some scattered across the state, but there aren't that many. So there might have been some anger here and there, but it wasn't on a scale that really. It's not the same as it is in a lot of other states.
Right. And was this a caucus or an actual primary?
It was a primary.
And were there any voting irregularities or polling problems or anything like that? Or is that not something that – are those not problems that you have in Louisiana? I would expect you would, like we have here. But.
I mean, they can happen anywhere, but I haven't heard of anything out of the ordinary.
Okay, well,
it's
that's good.
Things like that have been an issue with caucuses. Nothing nefarious. There's been no sign that it's actually been directed at one candidate or the other, but caucuses have had problems where they've been overwhelmed or unprepared. But
yeah.
The primaries pretty much everywhere on both sides, from what I understand, have gone very smoothly.
Well, that's a relief. And what about support for Marco Rubio in Louisiana? Has there been what percentage did he end up with?
I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was very distant third. It was not good at all. And
okay.
that was about what we expected after his last few bad weeks. He's just not been doing very well in the South, really. I mean, he could have done worse on Super Tuesday, but still not great and not what a front runner for the Republican Party really wants. And
have you looked at the results like in Georgia, for example? He won the Metro Atlanta area, like the four counties that are part of the, you know, central Metro Atlanta. Did you see any – have you looked at any of those numbers for Louisiana to see if anybody dominated, like, New Orleans, or was it pretty spread out?
I'd have to look at those much more closely.
Yeah, okay. We're all nerds here, so, you know, we don't have anything better to do than look at all the county results. I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Tim. Thank you.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Singh, and thank you for being with us again. Let me start by quickly giving a public service announcement for those of our listeners who were wagering. I know for certain that Phil Robertson was an early supporter of Cruz, and I think one of his sons endorsed Trump, but don't quote me on that. Now, moving right ahead, could the Democrats in Louisiana somehow pull off a win in that U.S. Senate race that because of what happened in the governor's race, or was the governor's race just a unique situation because of David Bitter?
That's a great question, and it is something I have thought of. Many people, including me, did underestimate John Bel Edwards, the Democratic governor in Louisiana last year. So after that, I don't want to say that there's no chance Democrats can snag that Senate seat. That said, a federal race in Louisiana is very, very different from a state race. In in a federal race, it's much easier for Republicans to argue a vote for the Democratic candidate is a vote for Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Bernie Sanders. They tried doing that with Barack Obama in the governor's race, but it didn't work nearly as well as they needed it to, just because so many voters, not just in Louisiana, but pretty much everywhere, they can differentiate between state politics and national politics. They do understand that governor races are different and that they aren't really giving someone that they hate in the White House an extra vote. So Bitter, as you said, he had some pretty unique problems. And even though he is retiring this year, so that won't be as big of a factor at all. None of the Republican candidates that are running, I think, are incredible candidates, but none of them have a sort of skeleton in the closet. So if we have a Louisiana race that's between a pretty generic Republican and almost any Democrat, the Republican's going to win hands down.
And if we do see a Democrat prevail in Louisiana on election night, it's just almost a gimme that the Democrats have retaken the U.S. Senate, right?
Yes. Yes. It would, unless there's some major scandal that hits the Republican candidate that's just unique to Louisiana, if we're taking Louisiana, we've run the table. I do want to note, it's very, very unlikely either the race in Louisiana is going to be settled on election night. That's because we're going to be having the jungle primary in November. We're not going to have party primaries. Every candidate from every party is going to run on one ballot. And if someone gets a majority, they win the Senate seat. But there's so many candidates, that's extremely unlikely. So what's almost certain to happen is the two candidates with the most votes are going to advance. And that could be a Democrat and a Republican. It could be two Republicans. There's a chance it could be two Democrats, and that'd be an automatic pickup. But that would be like lightning striking at a lottery winner. Like, it could happen, but it's very unlikely.
So you're not looking at a scenario where there is like one candidate in that race now who has already separated themselves from the field in such a way that they could court that 50% threshold?
No, I don't see that. We have multiple strong Republicans. We have several notable Democrats. And if there was just one strong Democratic candidate, I'd say it's still very, very unlikely that it would happen. But maybe you'd have a chance. But with so many people splitting the vote, I think it's next to impossible that anyone's going to win in November. And we're just going to have to wait until December for the runoff.
All right, and I'm going to wheel to national politics with my next question and then throw it back to David, who I'm sure will continue with the national thing. In the last six presidential elections, 18 states and the District of Columbia, totaling 242 electoral votes, have voted Democratic. All the political junkies know about this because this constitutes what people call the blue wall. If we assume that either Donald Trump or Ted Cruz is the Republican nominee, could either of them break through that wall?
That's a really good question. It's something I thought of. Ted Cruz, he seems like a candidate who has much more. We pretty much know what we're getting with him. He's a far-right conservative. He's probably going to turn off a lot of people who even vote for Mitt Romney. You know, if the economy takes a massive plunge or there's a terrorist attack or something, then yes. And yes, all bets are off. A Republican could win a lot of these more marginal states like Wisconsin. But if things are about where they are now, with the economy doing well but not great and Obama not beloved but not hated, then I think someone like Cruz wouldn't be able to take any of those states. I think he has much more downside for the Republicans, but he is a bit more unpredictable. He does appeal to a lot of working class voters who have been exiting the Democratic Party, but some of them still aren't quite gone yet. But at the same time, he has so many, many, many statements against pretty much every group under the sun that Democrats would not hesitate to use against him. Republicans haven't really been able to get their act together, but Democrats would not stop. And I just think that unless things are just so terrible for the Democratic Party that someone as vile as Ted Cruz or Donald Trump could win, that Trump would not make the sort of inroads he needs to make with Democratic voters to offset the losses I think he'd take.
Mm-hmm. So who would Hillary Clinton rather face, do you think, in the general election? If she's looking at the red and blue map right now, who would she rather face?
That's a great question. I've heard arguments from both sides. I think she'd rather face Cruz just because he's so much more predictable. Donald Trump, I think he would lose by worse than Ted Cruz, but Donald Trump is a lot more unpredictable. He's willing to go much, much further in the gutter than Ted Cruz is able to. And, you know, someone that bad, yeah, he might very well just destroy himself, but he could land a few blows. So I think Hillary would rather take the person who she knows exactly what he's going to do than the guy who could make things a lot stranger.
Yeah, as he has so far, yes. And with that, I will throw it back to David.
Yeah, well, I want to do a follow-up to this question, but then I want to get back into some Louisiana politics and y'all's budget, some congressional races. Could there be a possibility where Republicans that would like Rubio or Scott Walker or anything, Jeb Bush, anything that looks more establishment, could support Ted Cruz, try to get him to more delegates, maybe enough delegates to win the thing outright, or, you know, really close, and he's the leader, but then contest his constitutionality to serve because he was born in Canada, and the Republicans get rid of him, Tom Burke. And therefore, then they can go, well, in our convention, we got to replace him, so we can go with Marco, we can go with Jeb, we can go with somebody we wanted all along. Jeff, do you see a scenario in which they could support Cruz to get rid of Cruz because they don't like him anyway?
I'd never really thought of that, actually. That is.
It's so Machiavellian, David. I can't even believe you brought it up.
But I know how these people think. I mean, you know, they keep doing it against the president, and we know, I mean, anybody with any rational thought knows he was born in Honolulu. I mean, but we all know that Ted Cruz was born in Calgary. I mean, there is a difference.
I could see someone trying that, but I don't think they'd be able to get enough to convince enough voters that that's what they need to do. Because there are a lot of people who are voting for Rubio and Kasich now who, if they weren't on the ballot, maybe a lot of them would go for Cruz, but a lot of them would also go for Trump. And maybe some of them would stay home. Like maybe they'd go for Cruz mostly, but there's really no guarantee. Like, not everyone who's voting for Rubio and voting for Kasich hates Trump. So I don't see – I could see someone maybe trying something like that, but – I don't see them having enough organization or just pull with the voters to really be able to pull that off. And I think if we did somehow get some situation where Cruz was the nominee and then he was disqualified, I don't think we could really just give it to someone like Jeb Bush or Rubio who's run and lost. That would just blame everybody.
Yeah, I don't know. It popped in my mind as something that I could see them doing because they want to, you know, get rid of really Trump and Cruz, and that would be the way to kill two birds with one stone. Use Cruz against Trump, but then get rid of Trump's argument against Cruz. You get rid of both of them. Who knows?
Never know. I mean, we have really no idea what the courts would rule if it gets there and how long this would take. So there's a lot of risks to that. I mean, we are on pretty uncharted territory with this.
Yeah. Well, let me bring it back to the state of Louisiana. And this is one of the main reasons we wanted to have you on the show, because you know so much about their politics. And in 2015, we had our year review show, and I think all three of us gave some kind of award to either, you know, John Bell Edwards, MVP, biggest upset. I think we then gave it to the – one of us gave it the converse of it, you know, David Vitter, worst campaign, based on what John Bel Edwards did win the governorship. But now, knowing how bad the budget is, we almost have to ask why in the world did he want the governorship. Tell us just how bad is the budget situation? What can be done to fix it? How did it get here? Just enlighten us.
All right, so as you said, it's awful. The short term is there isn't enough money to pay for the current budget. So they're right now finishing up a special legislative session to just address this fiscal year. We're going to have another legislative session almost right away to address the next fiscal year, and there's just the state is not bringing enough revenue, and there are a lot of reasons for that. One big reason is oil prices have dropped, and in an energy state like Louisiana, that's devastating. But another big reason is ex-Governor Bobby Jindal. He prepped himself so much to run for president that he did not spend much time being an effective governor. And Jindal was so obsessed with being able to say when he ran for president, I've never raised taxes, that he went through all these sorts of motions and games to make sure that he could do that. And Louisiana requires you to balance the budget. And so he found ways to balance the budget with some short-term gimmicks, and that would just not take you very far. And he found ways to just kind of raise revenue without really raising it, and it's just created this entire mess. And there's just not enough money to pay for everything. If Louisiana doesn't patch this very soon, it's going to have to make cuts to essential services like education. And Governor Edwards recently went on television saying, if we don't fix this, we're going to have to cut all these schools. We're going to have schools that have to close down. Students who are taking classes now, they're not going to get their degrees. And the legislature has passed or plans to pass some revenue streams, but the Republican State House especially, they've been very reluctant to make some of the tax increases that Governor Edwards wants. The alcohol tax especially, that one, the Senate passed it, the State House, a majority passed it, but it didn't get the required number of votes to go into effect. So the legislature, early next week, right now, I believe at this very moment, they're negotiating. And so it's going to be a frantic few days. And I don't think anyone's incredibly optimistic.
Yeah, it sounded bad. I think the headline that got even a lot of sports news was LSU football to be cut. Now, obviously, when you read into it, it was LSU classes to be cut. And if you can't go to class, you can't play sports because you actually have to represent a school. And so I guess that was kind of an attention getter. How did people react to that? Were they like, oh, no, let's do something, or, oh, my goodness, just another Democrat, you know, cutting something we love?
It's pretty hard to tell. I've heard reactions either way. Some people said that Edwards just made a huge mistake by even implying that LSU is going to be cut because that just brings in enough revenue, and LSU is just so sacred that if you cut that, even if you are trying to save money for something else, you're just touching the third rail. I've heard some other people who do argue that he was trying to be responsible, and he is genuinely making the argument that, yes, we have to make these cuts. So we're going to have to see what happens when the dust clears. I think a lot of Louisianans, even conservatives, do recognize that things are bad. You have to raise revenue, and you have to make some sacrifices. But people say that, but when they actually have to make those sacrifices, and if it's something like LSU football, which is pretty much the religion of the state, then they might sort of recognize that, yes, things are bad, but they might blame Edwards for it anyway. So we'll just have to see if we get to that point, what happens. But as much as people might recognize that this was Jindal's fault and that the Republican legislature has something to do with it, Edwards is the guy in charge now. And while people don't – well, except for maybe some ardent conservatives, everyone else doesn't blame him for what's going on right now. He's going to get blamed for whatever cuts we have to make. And – That's terrible, but that's what happens when you run for governor of a state that's in such dire straits.
Yeah, I don't envy him. If you put a list of politicians that I would least like to take their job tomorrow, he might be at the top.
Yeah.
It's a bad thing. and not of his doing, but, you know, he signed up to fix it, I guess. And good luck to him and all Louisianans and doing it. Well, let's talk about these congressional races. I'll go through the districts. And, Jeff, if there's nothing really there, say a word, say a sentence, and we can move on. The ones that really need talk, you put it up. Steve Scalise in the 1st District, he's the House Majority Whip. And the only rumored candidate is David Duke, but I have a feeling that David Duke is rumored for a lot of things that he's not running for just because he's a provocative figure, to be kind.
Yeah.
Anything there?
Yeah, he talked about running there last year, and, well, he's David Duke. He very well could run there just because. But even with Donald Trump's rise, David Duke really is not a popular figure in Louisiana. Some of his ideas, unfortunately, are, when they're dressed up a little bit, they are much more popular, but he himself isn't. And for one thing, a lot of the Republicans in that district, they're more business people who just don't want to be associated with Duke himself. Maybe they're okay with some of his associates, but not Duke himself. So if he did run there, wouldn't go very far.
Yeah, they would vote for the crook because it was important. Mm-hmm. Well, the 2nd district, that would be the New Orleans-based district, and I guess it goes all the way up to Baton Rouge. Cedric Richmond is the incumbent. There's a rumor of a Kip Holden, East Baton Rouge mayor, running, but that's just a rumor. Is that going to be just an uncontested seat?
I think it will be. Kip Holden didn't deny interest in running there, but the problem for him, for one thing, is Cedric Richmond. He's not really offended anyone in office. He's been pretty good, people have seen. And so when you're trying to get someone to fire an incumbent from your own party, it's really hard if you can't make an argument for why they need to go. Another thing is the seats. It's mostly in the New Orleans area. Most of the voters are around New Orleans. There is a bit of Baton Rouge, Kip Holden's base in the district, but much more of it is around New Orleans. So if Holden does try to make this a geographic battle, he's probably going to lose. So I don't think he's going to run, period, but I don't see Richmond losing anyway.
Yeah, I think that's one of those districts, if you keep your money in the bank and not in the freezer, you're going to be okay.
yep.
Their former congressman, Bill, didn't do that. The 3rd district, Charles Bustinay, he's running for Senate. This is going to be a recurring theme. There's a laundry list of Republicans, including Public Service Commissioner Scott Angell, who ran for, I guess he's been lieutenant governor. He ran for governor. He's the only name I recognize, but that's because I'm a Louisiana novice, unlike yourself.
Yeah, and Scott Angell, he is the most recognizable name in the field. When he ran for governor last year, he did very well in that district. Though all his candidates, he was the only one from that area around Lafayette. All the other candidates were from other places, so that did give him a bit of the home field advantage. But still, he's a guy who's very well known there. There is one potential problem for him. When David Vitter made it to the runoff against John Bell Edwards, the other Republican candidate, Jay Darden, outright endorsed Edwards, the Democrat, but Angell didn't go that far, but he didn't endorse anyone. So you could have a lot of Republicans, especially Republican donors, who still are angry about that. They may not have liked Vitter that much, but they did not want to see a Democrat in the governor's office. And, you know, if around Election Day Edwards is unpopular around here, especially, then I can see a lot of ads being run saying Scott Angell did not take action to stop John Bell Edwards or something like that.
Yeah. Well, my defense ad would be, I hated John Bell Edwards so much I helped him win the governorship. See what he's having to face now. that might be the inoculation. District 4, John Fleming, incumbent, is running for U.S. Senate. There is a Democrat rumored in this race, a Patrick Jefferson, a laundry list of Republicans, including Elbert Gilroy, who has run ads that have played on Atlanta television. That may not be the leading front runner, but there's a good many Republicans looking at it.
Yeah, this one's going to be pretty crowded, too. Yeah, as you said, Gilroy, he's kind of an oddball. He was a conservative Democrat. He switched parties, became the first Republican African-American in the state legislature since Reconstruction. But he ran for lieutenant governor last year, raised very little money, finished a distant 4th place. So I don't think he's going to take very many votes this time. We have a few candidates there. Probably the most interesting is State Representative Mike Johnson. He just got to the legislature last year in a special election, but he immediately made himself known because he pushed for a Louisiana version of Indiana's infamous Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And Johnson pushed for this bill knowing that gay marriage was probably going to be coming to Louisiana soon, so he wanted to give some outs for people who wanted to discriminate against gays. And after what happened in Indiana, after that triggered all these national boycotts, very few people in Louisiana, especially business leaders, wanted to touch this. They might not have really liked gay marriage, but they didn't want a giant boycott aimed at them. Bobby Jindal, though, he was about to run for president, and he said, hey, this is a great way for me to stand out from the field. So he pushed Johnson's bill, but it didn't go anywhere. It died very quietly in the legislature. So Johnson, he's an interesting guy. I could see him trying to rally religious voters, which around this part of Louisiana, that's a lot of voters. So he might very well come out on top after that whole debacle.
And yeah, I can see that. I can see that ad right now. Mike Johnson standing up for the high sexual mores that New Orleans during Mardi Gras is known for.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that'd be a real winner. District 5, Ralph Abraham is running unopposed. I'm assuming that's not much of a pickup target. He may not even get any opposition. Anything there?
Right. And same with the next district, District 6. Pretty much in Louisiana, we have 5 Republicans, 1 Democrat. That's definitely going to stay the same, almost certainly. The 4th district around Shreveport that we were just talking about, that district voted for Mitt Romney by about 20 points, but it still has some Democratic strength down ballot. John Bel Edwards did pretty well here, so there's maybe for this outside chance of a pickup, but I don't think it's incredibly likely. And this is a district where even if someone like Donald Trump or Ted Cruz is completely bombing nationwide, they're probably going to be still doing well in this part of the South, so that's the one district where I would take a small look at the Democrats, but I don't see anything changing in Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of our little Louisiana time. I want to ask one more national question. I'm going to pass it around to Catherine and Tim real quick if they've got anything. And that would be about Bernie Sanders' ability to continue to raise big dollars. You know, you can look at the analytics of the race. I mean, you can take your emotions out of it either way. Hillary Clinton has a pretty commanding lead with the delegates, with the superdelegates. Odds are, you know, Bernie Sanders can't overcome that. And yet he continues to get, you know, millions of dollars. I mean, I don't know how many he's raising in certain days, but $40 million over the course of the month of February. Would a lot of his supporters' money be better used at this point, go into like down ballot races, Senate seats that may decide the next Supreme Court justice, House races, even, you know, House and state Senate seats even?
I would say yes. Then again, I always encourage people to donate money to down ballot races over presidential races simply because your money is going to go much further there, because presidential races are just so vast. Anything is just a drop in the bucket. In a Senate race, a House race, especially a state legislature race, that money is going to matter much more. It's going to matter for more voters. So I would always encourage people to do that.
Yeah.
And I would say the same for Hillary people too. I mean, if she makes it to the general election, which it looks like she will, she's not going to have a problem raising money. And at some point, even if Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, they spend tons of money, she's going to be able to spend tons of money, and you get into diminishing returns territory very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But for House races, Senate races, state legislative races, that's much less of an issue. A lot less money is often being spent there, so your dollar's still going to matter much more.
Yeah, I think the map may expand a little bit more than we realize. Catherine, any more questions for Jeff?
I don't think I have any more.
That's okay.
I want to emphasize what you just said, though. It's not just that the money goes further in the state and, you know, the down ballot races, but it's really important that we try to strengthen our state legislatures, because across the country, a lot of what's, you know, hurting progressive values and progressive policies are these state legislatures, because there's many of them are so dominantly Republican that they're, you know, if we can talk about environmental laws, about women's health, about health care in general, all these things, and they're all, it's all happening at the state level, and people in general, I mean, I don't like to make big generalities, but people don't really pay attention to their state legislatures. And
yeah,
it's really where everything's happening, and it's where we build a bench for our presidential, our Senate and congressional candidates and presidential candidates 5, 10, 15 years from now. So I can't emphasize that enough.
Exactly. And I would add, you have a lot of state legislatures that are so gerrymandered where even the Republicans, they do have a strong majority, but there's a difference between a majority and a supermajority. In so many states, to pass a constitutional amendment or to pass certain taxes or other laws, you need a supermajority, you need usually two-thirds. And even if you have a state where, like Georgia, where the Republicans are probably going to be in charge for a long time, they're not guaranteed those two-thirds majorities forever. And if Democrats can just get to, say, 35% in one house, then they have a lot more negotiating power than if they're just 32%. It's a small difference, but it can make a world of difference for
it can. Any, you're absolutely right about that.
Jim, any questions for Jeff?
Yes, I have one very big one that I've been sitting here for nearly an hour thinking about, as a matter of fact. You know, Jeff, some of the main writers like you and David on Daily Coast are probably going to be writing more and more about an issue that, oh, I don't know, 6 months ago would have been unthinkable. You know, political junkies like us dream of that magical brokered convention. We've heard all year that it will not happen this year. But I look at the lay of the land, and it just seems to be far more plausible now that that's exactly what could happen, especially if the dust doesn't clear on March the 15th. Do you think that the chances of a brokered convention are at least becoming pretty decent right now?
Yes, I think we might have this nomination decided at the convention. A few weeks ago, I would have said, no, that's just a nice political fantasy, but it's happening, and it's very tough to see someone who isn't Donald Trump taking a majority of the delegates to be able to just win without going to the convention or without needing to have this be decided at the convention. And even Donald Trump, it's not even assured he's going to have that majority. So, yes, this very well could be decided at this. It's a good bet that this will be decided at the convention. I don't want to say it will be, but there is. And we're in pretty uncharted territory here. This used to be very common for the nomination to be decided at the convention, but we haven't had a time since 1976 where you didn't know the nominee when the convention started. And even in 1976, it was just between Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan on the Republicans. So it was unpredictable and chaotic, but you at least knew it was going to be one of those guys. This time, though, it's tough to see if Donald Trump doesn't have enough delegates to win outright, him getting enough to win the nomination there. But who else are the Republicans going to pick? I mean, Ted Cruz has his problems with the base, and it's hard to see them going for someone who ran and lost, like Rubio or Kasich or Jeb Bush. So you could see them try to resurrect Mitt Romney or take someone like Paul Ryan or maybe some obscure governor, but that carries its risk. So this kind of
wouldn't
thing used to be common.
Wouldn't the party leadership, though, Jeff, almost have to walk the tightrope like Carl Wallenda just to keep the convention from flying apart, to keep a significant number of delegates from walking out, especially if their guy is the leader and doesn't end up with a nomination, something like that?
Yes, and one thing I want to say is we use the term brokered convention and deadlock convention often interchangeably. they're very different things, and in this case, that's bad for the Republicans. What used to happen before the 70s and the rules changed was you'd have a lot of these nominations, you'd have a lot of states that they decide their delegates through processes that didn't really involve voters or only involved very select groups of voters. So with the party leaders of each state or just regions in the state who controlled the delegates. So they'd often maybe run some governor who didn't really want to be president, but who could just ensure that the delegates would be loyal to him. And then they'd make a deal to, say, throw their delegates to John F. Kennedy or whoever. That's not, that doesn't happen anymore. You don't have one person, one party leader, or one party organization that controls their state's delegation. So back in, say, the 30s or 40s, you could have one guy who's the state party chair saying, yes, I'll deliver all my state delegates to you for some state contracts or whatever. That doesn't happen anymore. The delegates aren't bound like that. And so you could have just individual delegates with individual interests, and some of these people are pretty random people who could just go on TV and embarrass everybody. And that would have been unthinkable in the days when we had broker conventions where the brokers were so powerful that you wouldn't cross them. That's not anymore. So when you have just thousands of people who are their own actors, who are making their own deals, that's just that we don't know what could happen there.
Well, then who would the power brokers be?
That's a great question. We don't know. We have some people who would try to be power brokers, like Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell and RNC people, governors. They could try to be power brokers, but they don't have the same influence that the old power brokers did. Back in the 30s or 40s, if you went against your power broker, you were probably going to be out of a job. You were going to be nobody. Today, if you do that, then that's not going to happen. They don't have the power to punish you the same way they did. They can't just ruin you. So there's just no way to really harness these thousands of people.
So what you're really trying to tell me then is that it would be great television for folks like us, but the convention itself would be a nightmare for the party, right?
Yes. And this would be a nightmare under any circumstances, but when you throw in someone like Donald Trump, who almost certainly would not accept a loss gracefully, then yes, we could get – I'm just happy it's them and not us.
Yeah, well, on that happy note, I'm going to throw it back to David.
Yes. Well, Jeff, we sure do thank you for coming on, and I'm sure people, our listeners, are the kind of folks that are reading Daily Kos all the time and seeing your work. And, you know, hopefully this, you know, people are listening to the Daily Kos podcast. I take it, are you on there sometimes as well?
We haven't been doing that for the elections yet, but there, as we get into election season, we will see. We will see what comes there.
Yeah,
And we do have a lot of very interesting stuff we're doing right now, especially with down-ballot races. As you were saying earlier, these races, they might not get as much attention, but they make such a difference. And especially this year where Democrats just can't just afford to keep the White House, we have to pick up at least 4 Senate seats to be able to retake the Senate and appoint someone to that court seat. We're watching those races like hawks, and those are just as important as what's going on in the struggle for the nominations.
Oh, yeah, I think the U.S. Senate's actually going to be more entertaining than the electoral map as we go on in this thing. But I'm sure we'll have you on probably more than once since we're just barely into March of 2016. But thanks again, Jeff.
Hey, well, thank you for having me back. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, and that, we're getting close to the end of the hour. Catherine, let me get it straight. Next week, you won't be here, correct?
That's correct.
Correct. And Wendy Davis is already lined up to be our special guest. Hopefully,
that's
going to change during the week. But, yeah, it'll be Tim, Wendy, and I. And we're going to talk about this Georgia Senate race we couldn't get to tonight. And so that's, we'll talk about that. And, of course, Catherine, you'll have to listen up then if you want to chime in on it when you come back the next week. Feel free.
Okay. Great. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Sounds good.
Good night,
thanks,
guys.
Everybody. Good night.
Good night.
We
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.